to VOA 1.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Susan Shand, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
A mobile application that gives users in China access to social media sites banned by the government has disappeared a day after its release. The app is called Tuber. It is designed for the Android mobile operating system. Tuber is supported by Chinese cybersecurity software company Qihu 360. A reporter at the state-run Global Times tweeted about its launch on October 9th. A great step for China's opening up. A day later, she added, "Update, Tuber is no longer on the Huawei App Store this afternoon." The app offers users limited access to websites such as YouTube, Facebook, and Google. It had about 5 million downloads after its release. A search for the app's website gave no results when VOA looked this week. It is unclear whether the government ordered the app to be removed. Before it disappeared last Saturday, Chinese users praised the app for its ability to visit banned websites. Several stories introducing Tuber were widely read last Friday on China's popular app, WeChat, before they were taken down. Tuber had a similar logo to YouTube's. Its main page offered YouTube videos. Another part of the site permitted users to go to Western websites banned in China. However, users noticed that the browser did not search everything. Sensitive political issues, such as the recent Hong Kong protests, were blocked, Reuters reported. YouTube requests for politically sensitive keywords, such as Xi Jinping, returned no results on the app, said TechCrunch. Some terms in the user's agreement also raised concerns. The terms said it could suspend users' accounts and share their information with security officials if they break the rules. That means using or sharing content considered to be rumors, dangerous to national security, against local laws, or harmful to social order. The terms also let security officials collect user information without their permission. Users of the app had to register through a Chinese phone number, which is tied to a person's real identity and permits position tracking. Since its removal last Saturday, those who downloaded the app received a message that Tuber is undergoing a system upgrade, TechCrunch said. Sarah Cook is a researcher on China, Hong Kong, and Taiwan at Freedom House, a rights group. She told VOA the availability of the new app for a short time might be a way for the Chinese government to create the illusion of choice to users. By facilitating and controlling the access, the Chinese Communist Party is able to ensure that their browsing indeed stays within approved limits, she said. Tuber is not the first browser in China that attempted to provide Chinese citizens with some access to the Western Internet. About a year ago, there was a similar effort made with a mobile browser called Kuniao that was approved by China's Ministry of Industry and Information Technology. But it was taken down in a few days. A Chinese blogger who has been following China's Great Firewall and who requested not to be identified told VOA that he was not surprised. He said the government wants people to use such sites instead of independent VPNs. But when they've become overly popular, the government will intervene, the blogger said. He added that he would not be surprised to see similar tools coming out soon. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
The World Bank has approved $12 billion in financing to help poor countries buy and give out coronavirus vaccines, tests, and treatments. The aim is to support the vaccination of up to 1 billion people in the developing world. The $12 billion in financing is part of a larger World Bank Group effort. It plans to spend up to $160 billion to help developing countries fight the COVID-19 pandemic, the bank said in a statement on Tuesday. The World Bank said its COVID-19 emergency programs are already reaching 111 countries. People in developing countries need safe and effective COVID-19 vaccines, it said. The World Bank is fast-tracking its delivery systems so that poorer nations have fair and equal access to vaccines, said the bank's president, David Malpass. He added that fair and equal access was important to defeat the pandemic and to help countries experiencing catastrophic economic and fiscal impacts. The International Finance Corporation is the agency of the World Bank that provides loans to private businesses. It is giving money to vaccine manufacturers through a $4 billion global health platform, the bank said. Researchers are working on creating more than 170 possible COVID-19 vaccines. The disease has killed more than 1 million people and sickened more than 38 million. It has also weakened many economies and left many people out of work. The world's richest countries have already bought up most of the world's possible COVID-19 vaccine supply through 2021. This has made health experts concerned that poorer countries will not be able to get the vaccine. The World Bank said it will use expertise and experience from its involvement in many large immunization programs worldwide and other public health efforts. The financing also is meant to help countries get medical tests and treatments and to support direction of logistics for vaccinations in the developing world. I'm Susan Shand.
Today on Everyday Grammar, our subject is indefinite pronouns. The pronouns we will consider today end with words such as thing, body, and one. Think about words such as nothing, something, everyone, and anybody. They are sometimes called expanded indefinite pronouns. Such pronouns are unusual and can be very interesting, as we will see.
Pronouns are words that take the place of nouns. Indefinite pronouns refer to people or things that are unknown or unclear. First, let's talk about how we arrive at expanded indefinite pronouns. In English, a few short and fairly common words have the ability to expand or grow. Take, for example, words such as every, any, no, and some. We can expand them by adding another word, such as body, thing, and one, to the ending.
Unlike most nouns, expanded indefinite pronouns can be modified by a single adjective. What is unusual about that, you ask? The adjective can, in some cases, come after the pronoun. Consider this example.
I think that something strange is happening here.
In this sentence, the word something is the subject of a clause. The adjective strange comes after it. In general, sentences have adjectives that come before nouns or after a linking verb, as in,
he is a strange man. That man seems strange.
Another unusual thing about these expanded indefinite pronouns is that when they show possession, they need an apostrophe followed by the letter S. Yet other pronouns that show possession, such as mine or his, do not have an apostrophe S. Consider these examples.
Somebody's phone is on the chair. Everyone's concerns were ignored.
When expanded indefinite pronouns are the subject of the sentence, English speakers treat them as singular in terms of the verb, even if the pronouns refer to many people. For example, an English speaker might invite a group of people to dinner by saying,
everybody is invited to dinner.
Here, everybody clearly means many people, but because it is the sentence subject, the verb is singular. After our fictional dinner invitation, a person might say,
everyone plans to be there.
But here is where things get a little strange. When the expanded indefinite pronoun is not the subject of the sentence, English speakers often use the pronoun they. This makes sense since everybody or everyone generally means several people. Consider this.
After everyone arrived for dinner, they played a football game.
But because there are questions about the meaning of these indefinite pronouns, English speakers also use they when talking about one person. Consider this example.
Someone sent me a text message yesterday, but they didn't say their name. I didn't write back to them.
The reason the English speaker used they is because the pronoun someone is not clear. It gives no information about the person's sex. It could be a man or a woman. Since gender is unclear, English speakers use the term they as a kind of gender-neutral pronoun.
When you read books written in English or watch American television shows, pay attention to how native speakers use the group of indefinite pronouns that we talked about today. Listen for subject-verb agreement. Ask yourself about what the indefinite pronoun is doing in the sentence. Consider why the speaker used an indefinite pronoun instead of another pronoun. These questions may be difficult, but remember this. With hard work, anything is possible. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. 1852 was a presidential election year in the United States. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Baltimore, Maryland. The meeting opened in June of 1852. Delegates agreed that a man must win two-thirds of the convention's votes to be the Democratic candidate. On the first ballot, no one received two-thirds of the vote, so the voting continued. Finally, on the 47th ballot, support began to increase for someone considered an unlikely candidate. His name was Franklin Pierce. Pierce was from the northeastern state of New Hampshire. He was a lawyer and former state lawmaker. He also had served in the United States Senate and House of Representatives. He became an officer in the Army during the U.S. war with Mexico. On the 49th ballot, Pierce won the Democratic nomination. He would be the party's candidate for president.
Pierce was a passionately loyal adherent of the Democratic Party and of its principles of negative governance domestically and spread eagle expansionism in foreign affairs.
Historian Michael Holt wrote a book about Franklin Pierce. Mr. Holt describes Pierce as someone who was like most Democrats at the time. In other words, he did not think the federal government should intervene much in efforts to help build up and develop the nation. But he wanted the United States to play a big and powerful role internationally. Naturally, Democrats did not agree on every policy issue. In 1852, the party was sharply divided on whether the government should or could permit slavery to continue in the United States. But Democrats decided to limit their fighting with each other during the election campaign, and they all agreed to support Pierce. The Whig Party held its presidential nominating convention in Baltimore 2 weeks after the Democrats met. The same thing that happened at the Democratic convention now happened at the Whig convention. Delegates voted over and over again, but no man got enough votes to win. It took 53 ballots before one of the men, General Winfield Scott, won the nomination. On election day, Pierce won a crushing victory. The Democrats won not only the presidency, but also strong majorities in Congress. The Democrats' victory was so great that many people thought the Whig Party was finished. In fact, many Whigs themselves hoped their party was destroyed. Like the Democrats, Whigs disagreed with each other about slavery. Northern Whigs wanted to form a new anti-slavery party. and Southern Whigs wanted to form a party that would better represent their interests. The Whigs lost badly in the 1852 elections because, unlike the Democrats, they were not able to bridge the differences between their Northern and Southern members. Franklin Pierce was 48 years old when he took office. He was the youngest man yet to be elected president. He was charming and made friends easily, but those who knew Pierce best worried about him. They knew that under all his friendly charm, he was a weak man. They feared the duties and problems of the presidency would be too great for him to deal with. Pierce also faced a difficult situation in his personal life. Two of his children had died when they were babies. A third child was killed in a train accident shortly before Pierce moved to the White House. In addition, his wife, Jane, did not like living in Washington, D.C. She did not support her husband's campaign for presidency. Years earlier, she had urged him to resign from the Senate and return to New Hampshire. She did not want to go back to Washington. When her husband was elected, she agreed to live there, but she rarely saw anyone. One of her close friends took her place at public events. Historian Michael Holt says Franklin Pierce's main goal as president was to keep his party united. One way to maintain party unity was to adopt popular Democratic policies. He promised strong support for expanding the territory of the United States. He also promised a strong foreign policy. During his term in office, Pierce successfully negotiated with Britain to gain American fishing rights along the coast of Canada. He also supported diplomatic and trade talks with Japan. However, he was unsuccessful in an attempt to buy Cuba from Spain. National issues presented President Pierce with a more difficult problem. Now that the election was over, some Democrats felt it was time once again to raise the issue of slavery. The Compromise of 1850 had settled the question of slavery only in the Western territories. But anti-slavery activists said the compromise should have done more to end slavery throughout the country. And pro-slavery activists said the agreement did not protect slave owners' rights. They did not want the federal government to intervene in slavery anywhere. As president in 1853, Pierce had to choose between the competing sides. He could support the Compromise of 1850 and say the dispute over slavery was settled. Or Pierce could try to make peace with both anti- and pro-slavery extremists. Giving the extremists jobs in his administration would be the easy way to satisfy their demands. And that was the policy Pierce chose.
Contemporaries at the time predicted that this attempt to share the plums would wreck the party, and it did.
Historian Michael Holt says Pierce sought to include men from competing sides of the Democratic Party in his cabinet. Pierce named William Marcy of New York as Secretary of State. Marcy wanted to limit the spread of slavery and keep the Union together. Jefferson Davis of Mississippi was named Secretary of War. Davis, more than any other man, represented Southern slave owners. He threatened to take the South out of the Union if the government set any limits on slavery. Caleb Cushing of Massachusetts was named Attorney General. Although a Northerner, Cushing was a friend of many Southerners. He was a very able man, but his loyalties were not clear. James Buchanan of Pennsylvania was named Minister to Britain. All these men had strong ideas about the future of the United States. President Pierce found it difficult to control them. One senator even said the administration should not have been called the Pierce administration because Pierce did not lead it. He said it was an administration of enemies of the Union who used the president's name and power for their own purposes. As president, Franklin Pierce faced another difficult question. Where should the United States build its new railroads? The country had expanded, and white settlers were moving west. Many were hungry for good transportation. They wanted railroads that reached across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. Engineers decided that four new rail lines would be possible. They could cross the southern, central, or northern parts of the United States. Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, a Democrat, proposed that three of the lines be built. He said the government could give land to the railroad companies. The companies could then sell the land to get the money they needed to build the lines. A Senate committee discussed the issue. Its members proposed that only one railroad line be built. But which one? Many congressmen believed a southern line would be best. There would be little snow in winter, and the railroad would cross lands that were already organized as states or official territories. A northern or central line would face severe winter weather, and it would have to cross a large, wild area called Nebraska. Nebraska was neither a state nor a territory. As a result, it did not yet have a local government that could support a railroad. In addition, many congressmen did not want Nebraska to develop a government. The reason, once again, was slavery. Michael Holt says members of President Pierce's party hoped the effort to organize Nebraska would unite Democrats once again. Instead, Mr. Holt says the Nebraska Territory caused more conflicts and ruined Pierce's administration. The bill increased divisions between Democrats and Whigs and between pro-slavery activists and anti-slavery abolitionists, and it brought the country one step closer to civil war. As one Northerner wrote, it was said hundreds of years ago that a house divided against itself cannot stand. The truth of this saying is written on every page in history. It is likely that the history of our own country may offer fresh examples to teach this truth to future ages.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.